Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, August 29th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly look at those who cover the news. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute, here with faculty colleagues from the Missouri School of Journalism, Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. On our program this week, the fact-checkers are busy evaluating political ads and convention speeches, but does the Romney campaign expect a double standard? Or are the reviews largely one-sided? How well can we measure the truth versus distortions? The media are up to some new tricks they hope will make watching politics more engaging. We'll even demo a couple of apps that fit into that space. The departing public editor of the New York Times says Times journalists share a political and cultural worldview that, quote, virtually bleeds through the fabric of the paper, leading to some stories being treated more like causes than news subjects. And media coverage of Neil Armstrong's death focuses more on his heroic moon landing 43 years ago than on his space policy advocacy in the last few years of his life. So let's start with the GOP convention and the trend that's ballooned in 2012 news coverage, the rise of the fact-checkers. The most prominent brand in this space is PolitiFact, with their trademarked truthometer that rates campaign claims on a scale from true to pants on fire. Here are two ads still running in parts of the country and online that have earned that worst score. The first is from the Romney campaign.
In 1996, President Clinton and a bipartisan Congress helped end welfare as we know it by requiring work for welfare. But on July 12th, President Obama quietly announced a plan to gut welfare reform by dropping work requirements. Under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check. And welfare to work goes back to being plain old welfare. Mitt Romney will restore the work requirement because it works.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
And here's the latest pants on fire ad from the Obama campaign.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Every woman who believes decisions about our bodies and our health care should be our own is troubled Mitt Romney supports overturning Roe v. Wade. Romney backed a law that outlaws all abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. And that's not all.
I'll cut off funding to Planned Parenthood.
For women, Planned Parenthood means life-saving cancer screenings and family planning services. But for Mitt Romney...
Planned Parenthood, I'm going to get rid of that.
We have links on our blog that will give you the detailed PolitiFact critiques of those ads, but in essence, they say that the pants-on-fire rating goes to the Romney welfare-to-work ad because it distorts the motivation and the likely result of a rule change made by the Obama administration. The Obama abortion ad also fails, according to PolitiFact at least, because it provides no evidence that Romney wants to outlaw abortions even in cases of rape or incest. Well, Charles, you brought to our attention the welfare ad, especially because the Romney campaign appears to want it both ways. They want to use quotes from fact-checkers when it suits their aims, but they just as soon say we won't be dictated by them when it comes to their own claims.
Yeah, this is an interesting political strategy, and I think it's an overt political strategy. They had a pollster who was quoted this week saying, you know, effectively, we're not going to be dominated by fact-checkers. In other words, we're sort of in a post-truth political campaign season. It's fascinating. I mean, it's I've never seen anything as covert as the sort of subtleties of the Obama falsehoods, and they're very subtle. And if you read the pants on fire thing, they have a hard time getting to pants on fire. And I would imagine the Romney campaign will call on Obama, as they have several times already during the campaign season, to pull the ad down. And in a couple of cases, they were ads that super PACs ran, and Obama said, can't do much about that. Regardless, the Romney camp's very overt decision to say, we don't care anymore. We're just not going to hew a campaign that sticks to the facts is, in my short political history, unprecedented. I guess I'd have to say I see the distinctions you say there, and sometimes the Obama ads get that, you know, pants on fire or failed rating through more subtlety, perhaps, than the Romney ones. But I can't believe that the Obama campaign or the super PACs that support him are going to be any more likely to stop running deceptive ads just because the fact checkers are out there checking them out.
I don't know. I mean, I would imagine that if you are the sitting president, and maybe this isn't a partisan thing, maybe this is the incumbent versus the non-incumbent. If you are sitting in the White House, it's harder for you to go, yeah, we're going to lie. We're going to lie because our people like it. I didn't see anybody come out and go, you know, on that Planned Parenthood thing, our people really like that ad, so we're going to keep running it, which was their rationale. Our people like it, so we're going to keep running it.
Well, so Lee, you've been involved over the years in classes and in other venues as sort of truth squatting or truth checking of ads. And I just wonder about those two ads we played before we get into some of the deeper questions. Do you think that PolitiFact was right to say those ads were pants on fire? They were outright falsehoods because of the way they portrayed the Romney and Obama positions on those two issues.
Well, I was at a conference earlier this year with the guy who invented PolitiFact, and he was very frank that the whole pants on fire rating thing is nothing more than a marketing gimmick, and sure, that the research that's been done on PolitiFact, and there is beginning to be, you know, some decent stuff out there now, says a couple of things that are really important. One, PolitiFact, despite what some of the stuff we posted on the blog alleges, doesn't really pick on one side more than the other. But secondly, there are a whole bunch of readers of PolitiFact who only read the pants on fire, true, mostly true label, and don't really dig down into what PolitiFact is providing, which is a lot more, in my view, subtle analysis. So in a way, in order to market it and in order to get it noticed, it's kind of, in some ways, sort of undercutting the job that it really wants to do, which doesn't answer your total question.
Well,
Mike,
is that the fault then of PolitiFact for trying to have it both ways by using these teases or these sort of oversimplified scoring systems while trying to do the real detailed analysis? Or is it the audience's fault for not taking the further step and reading all the way through it?
That would be a yes. I mean, I think that PolitiFact lives in their real world. They want to make money, so they knew they had to market it. They came up with this thing. My students in ethics class a couple of years ago found a much older thing called the Mendacity Index, which basically tries to sort of label as only a little bit mendacious or really horribly mendacious various sorts of lies. Mendacity, of course, is a word that comes to us from cat on a hot tin roof. I mean, you know, it's not a pants on fire kind of phrase. But I think the other thing that's interesting about what PolitiFact is doing is that they're actually analyzing the verbal claims in the ads. And so one of the things that is most striking about those ads has little to do with the words that are said and a great deal to do with the imagery that's on the screen. Right. And so one of the things when my students do fact checking and when a lot of other people are now starting to do truth squads and ad, they're paying more attention to the visuals, because you don't have to listen to what either one of those as says to get a warm, fuzzy notion or an icky, awful notion about what the topic is.
You know, and in some ways, I actually think it would be better if we had more of that in these sort of fact-checked articles anyway, because there are many ways in which you can interpret, quote, what the facts are about the script or the words that are spoken. But if you actually use the right language of visual grammar, in some ways, you can talk about that in less controversial ways than you can about the script itself. Well, I wonder, Charles, you know, we always see that the partisans on either side, left or right, dispute these findings from the fact-checkers when they conflict with their own talking points. For example, I remember when liberals were crying foul last year when PolitiFact called the claim that the Republicans were going to kill Medicare. They said that was the lie of the year. Oh, no. Conservatives, on the other hand, are really upset when the White House said they said that the White House robbed Medicare to pay for Obamacare when the Republicans said that. Well, that's just not accurate at all, even though Politico called that mostly false. So I suppose you could say in some ways this is an indication that journalists are just doing their jobs if both sides aren't happy. On the other hand, it seems to me that at least some of the more intellectual opponents can marshal lots of facts that seem to support their arguments and run counter to the claims of the journalists doing the fact-checking.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I generally, you know, I'm always a more speech is the best solution kind of guy, so you can always counter it with more speech. The problem is, where do facts find a shelter in the storm that is the political season? I mean, I think the voters look left and they look right and they hear claims and counterclaims, and ultimately they've got to be able to go somewhere to figure out what that elusive thing called the truth is. And when a campaign is as willing as this campaign is, I think, to sort of sling non-fact at each other. Now, the occasional broadside that steps over the line is one thing. A strategy based on deception is another. And let's not forget, we also have the USS Medicaid lie out there right now, in which Romney, again, on the stump day after day, is talking about Obama cutting, what is it, $750 billion, which is, again, Politico has said, patently, absolutely untrue. And I think this leaves us a bit flat-footed in the press because you don't really know how to deal with that kind of strategy.
I'm not sure either, Lee, that you can really do yourself a favor if you're a Politico or any of these others by sort of the fine distinctions that they make, whether it's one versus four Pinocchios on the Washington Post, or it's true, mostly true, half true, mostly false, false, pants on fire. I mean, how do you decide and how do you convince your readership how one is really different from the other? For example, Politico said that Harry Reid's statement a while ago that Romney hasn't paid any taxes in 10 years was a pants-on-fire lie, okay? They called the Obama super PAC that ran that wrong. However, when the super PAC said that Mitt Romney tried to kill a woman, basically, by closing her husband's steel factory, that was merely false. Well, how do we really tell the difference between false and a claim that's pants on fire?
I'm not sure that we do, other than it brings to mind two aphorisms, unfortunately. One is from Jim Carrey, not the actor, but the communications scholar, who said, there is no such thing as a fact without context. And if anything illustrates that, it's these claims and counterclaims about, well, what would the Medicare changes really actually mean? And what does it mean to allow states the freedom to ask for some liberty from the welfare work connection that was built into that 96 bill? I mean, so that's kind of on the one, I think that's kind of on the one side. The other side is the thing that troubles me more about this is, I believe it was Goebbels who pioneered the notion, to great misfortune of many, that if you tell a lie long enough, loud enough, people will believe it, which gets me to my second aphorism. Common sense is maybe not so common as we sometimes like to think. Some of these claims on their face are not commonsensical, but I don't see people sort of applying that kind of standard.
You know, Charles, you also have the problem for the fact checkers that they used to have this space kind of to themselves when there weren't a lot of other voices out there doing this. But now that the journalists have got better at the fact checking process, they're having to compete with all these other folks out there, partisans, amateurs, people who are interested in topics for whatever reason, who are doing the same kind of thing sometimes with as big a megaphone as the media.
Yeah, it's one of the wonderful things about the internet is that It means we don't have to just rely on institutional fact checkers. They can become sort of a major place for people to go and see aggregated fact checking, but they can go off and do their own as well. And what I think ultimately, though, really scares me is when people start to assail the notion of fact checking. And that's what we're seeing, is sort of a partisan attack on the institutions of fact checking themselves. And that's troubling.
Lee, I want to pick up just a related point before we get off this subject of whose facts make it into stories. You brought to our attention a study that was released yesterday by the Women's Media Center, and it shows that 3/4 of all the newspaper stories that have been written so far about the 2012 presidential campaign have been written by men. Does that matter?
I don't know whether it does or not, but what struck me about the finding was that there are a lot of women doing a lot of political reporting now, and to have 3/4 of the stories, I sort of wondered, what's the institutional gate here? And that's insider baseball, so I sort of wondered, who are the assignment editors who are making these assignments, and whose stories are getting past the gate, and is it more the case of the women are writing about Ann Romney, whereas the men get to write about Paul Ryan and policy? And that really does, I mean, if it's that way, then that's just out and out sexism and a form of nasty sort of intellectual discrimination, and people should protest.
I also don't know. I don't know. I don't have anything to gauge this on, whether the broadcast media or the exclusively online media that cover the campaigns have that same sort of gender bias. We'll maybe somebody will do a study and we'll bring it up on the show. Well, as we mentioned last week, the conventional wisdom is that nothing much new comes out of the major party conventions these days. So the media are trying all sorts of things to add spice to their coverage. Wolf Blitzer is hosting conversations from the CNN grill, while over at Morning Joe on MSNBC, they're working out of the Elephant Bar. You've got several newspapers, as well as the Associated Press now, who have their own studios on site, and they're doing live streaming of all the speeches. They're having their own news talk shows from these newspapers. And then you have third parties who are rolling out some really interesting apps that you can use for a so-called second screen experience when you're watching TV at the conventions. I guess I would just ask, Charles, for your sort of general impression about all these sort of innovations that the media are trying. Do you like them? Make any difference? Is it just, you know, trying to cover up something that isn't very interesting in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I love throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks, just as a strategy for digital innovation anyway. So I like to see all that experimentation going on around apps and second screen environments and everything else. And Mike and I sort of geek out on that stuff anyway, so guilty as charged. That having been said, the conventions are just silly. I mean, when you look at them from a distance, I don't care what your political affiliation, they're silly events for party insiders. They're as much a party as they are business, maybe more so. And they are an occasion for silliness on behalf of the networks. And man, are they silly. I mean, I was watching, just kind of flipping around last night from channel to channel, and I gave up after a while because Mike was saying before that it's the self-selection and the ideological editing that's taking place. I just, you know, I ended up predictably enough at PBS because that's the place that sort of keeps me sane.
Lee, can we overcome those problems with gimmicks and innovations?
I don't know, because as much as you and Charles like to geek out, you know, I'm sort of the where's my quill person of, you know, of the three of us. But like Charles, I like the innovations. Because I think journalists at this point don't know what to do with an audience that's become so tightly niched, apparently on ideological lines, when it comes to covering politics. I think throwing it against the wall, and that makes a lot of sense. The interesting thing will be, is it that same sort of approach when we cover science, or when we cover economics, or when we cover social movements, or when we cover the theater? And those are questions that I just don't know how well the political landscape translates into using the same sort of approach for sort of other topic areas.
Yeah. Charles, I'm going to force the rest of our audience to geek out with us for just a second, because I'm going to try something for those folks who are watching the video of the program, and I'll try to describe it for those who are listening. But I thought I'd demo a couple of really interesting new apps that have come out directly related to television coverage of politics and campaigns. One of them is called the Super PAC app, and this was actually produced by a couple of folks who were taking a seminar at MIT and went to some hackers event or whatever. It's not, you know, sanctioned by the mainstream media or whatever, but here's what it does. You can literally take your smartphone or your iPad, we're showing it on the screen now, and if you hear or see a campaign commercial appear on the air, then you can press a button and this app will actually listen to and identify the ad and the source of the ad. So earlier before the show, I played an ad from the Crossroads GPS Super PAC, the one that we've all, you know, kind of seen about, you know, a newscaster saying it's the worst recovery we've ever seen. Well, if you pull up the app, I can play back that video clip again and analyze it, you know, every way I want. I can see claims that have been made about this ad, a sort of a truth checking of it. I can see how much money the Super PAC has spent. And through social media, I can rate it myself to see whether I and others think I loved that ad. I thought it was fishy. I thought it failed. I can then actually push a button and I can see what everybody's talking about right now as far as political commercials and watch those. And I can even sort the ads that people have ranked by a variety of categories so that I can share that information with my friends. And then there's another app that I wanted to show you, which isn't just about politics, but it relates to political coverage particularly. And this app is called Boxfish. And what Boxfish does, and I think we can show this on the screen. If you can't see it on the screen, you can download it. But Boxfish essentially is a way to supercharge your TV viewing by being able to see what people are talking about by topic, second by second. So this app is hooked up to the program source where I get my television. In this case, it happens to be CenturyLink. And it tells me all the shows where they're talking about a given topic, whether it's Romney, the conventions, Obama, whatever. And I can track second by second. I can even use this as a tuner. If I see something that's being said on the show that I like, I can use it to tune my TV to that channel. I can read a transcript so I can see live what people are saying second by second about the topics I care about, and then I can share it via social media with other people. So it seems to me, when we talk about trying to find a way to use the internet to produce this second screen experience, it will get people engaged in whatever it is, the political process or news in general. This is a pretty interesting slate of apps.
That's very cool. I'll be downloading that tonight, because I'm very enthused about the potential of second screen environments to really, I mean, if you think about it, it could revolutionize not only the way we watch and interact with what was sort of a passive medium, but it also has another advertising platform. So you look at it from a revenue perspective as well, and it's interesting stuff.
That latter app, by the way, one writer described it in a blog this week as like crack for news junkies. So we'll see if it turns out to be that way. Of course, everybody's taking to Twitter as part of the campaign coverage as well, Lee, and including the media. There are lots of parties out there that have their own Twitter strategies, including the Republicans and the Democrats, to get their message out. But I thought it was pretty interesting that the Republicans were overwhelmed, at least last night, by their opponents. Here are a couple of the top 10 most retweeted posts. Someone calling themselves LOL GOP proposed a drinking game. Quote, drink when you see a non-white person in the RNC audience. And comedian Andy Borowitz tweeted this. Tonight, I hope Chris Christie explains why he thinks gay marriage would hurt his state more than Jersey Shore has. So at the moment, at least, the Republican opponents are using Twitter more to their advantage than the Republicans. We'll see if that turns out to be a mirror image when the Democrats have their convention.
Well, I think it's sort of all those of us who are Jon Stewart wannabes, and I keep going back to Science Fiction Theater 3000, where you saw these horrible old science fiction movies with these two people who just gave snarky comments all the way through. It is a nice way to be able to talk back to your TV set. On the other hand, it's one of those illustrations of what's sauce for goose is sauce for the gander. You think this can't be done to you? Oh, just wait.
Well, yeah, a frequent, if sometimes tiring, topic that we discuss on this program, and it's come up again this week, has to do with media bias. The New York Times kind of shot itself in the foot in that regard this week. The paper's public editor, who is stepping down on Sunday, wrote in his final column defending the Times' political coverage. But Arthur Brisbane did say also that many reporters and editors, quote, share a kind of political and cultural progressivism, for lack of a better term, that this worldview virtually bleeds through the fabric of the Times. As a result, Brisbane says, developments like the Occupy movement and gay marriage seem almost to erupt in the Times, overloved and undermanaged, more like causes than news subjects. I wonder what you think about that, Charles?
Well, I would hope that there's a certain cultural progressivism that instills itself into every journalist. I was kind of left going, what? Because I remember following, for example, the Occupy movement very carefully, and the New York Times was certainly not the standard bearer when it came to covering the Occupy movement. I mean, yes, there is a progressivism in the heart of a Times reporter, just like there is of Tribune reporter, in that they sort of stand, hopefully, for the small guy, the person who's being crushed by the corporate interest and the oligarchs and the system. They ought to be. If you read the New York Times regularly, there's a lot of consumer stuff in the New York Times that only about 0.5% of the country can afford. It is an elitist publication aimed at elitists. And I'm not really sure whether they care whether you're a liberal elite or a conservative elite, provided you got the money.
I don't disagree with that, but Lee, I also have to say I think that Brisbane had an inside view of what was going on in the newsroom, and as a journalist for a few years, he adds some credibility, at least to the charge, that there is a slant. Now, he doesn't say it applies to their political coverage so much as it applies to coverage of everything else.
Well, I think in some ways it's true, but he used a political metaphor, and I'm not sure that that's the best metaphor. It's certainly a metaphor. But for example, he could have said that the New York Times is a very urban newspaper. We have a long history of urban-rural distinctions in this country that is sometimes about politics, but about a lot of other things as well. The Times is very urban. And yes, that bleeds through the paper. It is, after all, a creature of New York City. You would expect perhaps something different. I wouldn't. The same thing goes for what Charles said. If you look at the business and the finance sections of the Times, it's very biased. It's biased in favor of people who have lots of dough, of people who want to invest in the stock market. So it's not biased in favor of the people who literally, and there are many of them in this country, who don't know where their next paycheck or where their next meal is coming from. So I agree in some ways with what he said. I just don't think that in many ways it either went far enough or that it used the right metaphor. Politics is not synonymous for everything.
I suppose so. I think perhaps it resonated a bit more with me than with you, but I did think, Charles, he did make another point that we should at least talk about just briefly, and that's the need for the Times and every media company to be a bit more transparent about what its culture or its values are.
Yeah, I could not possibly agree more. And part of that is the trap of objectivity of person, right? This idea that if you are in favor of, as he described it, cultural progressivism, as if that's a disease, to be in favor of, I don't know, democracy, equality, social justice, those sorts of things we should be unabashedly for. And we're not, because we're trying to hew this artificial dance in which we try to be objective to people who would criticize us no matter what, every day, all day.
Well, finally, let's look very briefly at a story that during a typical news week would have generated much more coverage than it did, the death of Neil Armstrong, the former Apollo astronaut and first man on the moon.
I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Oh, that looks beautiful to me, Neil.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here. Are you getting a TV picture now, Houston?
Neil, yes, we are getting a TV picture. You're in our field of view now.
And in fact, most of the world got that TV picture. It was one of the most watched events ever, Lee. But you know, it's not like there was no coverage, but with the Republican convention, the tropical storm, the summer staffing the news, and whatever the reason, it seemed like the coverage was kind of muted and maybe even perfunctory this time.
I think there was, this is one of my things about, okay, let's connect the dots. I don't know if this is progressive or not, but we've got Neil Armstrong dying. He was obviously an admirable, modest person, but his big shtick was how we would best explore space. Coming within 2 weeks of when we're all just really fascinated by what's going on Mars and Curiosity, I have yet to see a single journalistic piece that puts those two things together in a logical and insightful way to talk about what's our goal here. And yet to me, that's logical. That's the sort of journalism we should be doing.
And in the general interest media, at least, I saw very little reporting at all about Armstrong's positions on the manned space program, his critique of the Obama administration, the defense of all that. In science publications, you saw that, but not too much otherwise. It was otherwise just sort of the hero worship. Remember back in the days when the space program really mattered. Well, with that, we're going to have to say goodbye for this week. Thanks to Lee and Charles for offering their perspectives. Thanks to our technical team, RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers. And thanks to you for watching or listening. You might like to check out our blog under talkshows at kbia.org, where you can find links, audio, and video, or leave a comment. You can also do that at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.